At the outset, I would like to thank the organizers for the kind invitation to speak in the Renzo Barroso Memorial Symposium. At this instant, I would like to recall the encouragement and support provided by Dr. Barroso in the early years when we were setting up a research program in cervical cancer screening focusing on developing countries in IARC. And again, his services to set up the initial colposcopy services in some of our research programs in French-speaking Africa. And we all agree that cervical cancer is a very rare long-term outcome of a very common infection of the surface epithelium. And in fact, in statistical probability, it occurs in about 1 out of every 10,000 women infected in their lifetime. So it is such a very rare outcome of a very common infection. And this is very unique. Cervical cancer is very unique in the sense that we understand the natural history, the best for among all cancers. We know what causes it and how it progresses. We have a better understanding of the preclinical disease and how we can manage it. Unfortunately, it has it's one of the eminently preventable and treatable cancers. So in all stages of natural history, there are effective interventions available, and particularly the interventions are extremely effective and cost-effective at its preclinical phase. And again, it is essentially a disease of poor women. It's a poor socioeconomic status. So the incidence, the epidemiology of the disease is heavily influenced by several factors, particularly socioeconomic development. And in fact, for several years, at least in the 60s and 70s, people were debating the rapid decline in cervical cancer incidence and mortality in developing countries. Is it really has to something to do with the extensive pap smear programs, the quite often repeated pap smear programs in the developed world? Or is it something which is an accompaniment of an extensive socioeconomic development in the Western societies? And in fact, in the 1980s, when IARC looked into the observational evidence coming from several developed countries, they declared that, in fact, the extensive pap smear programs in developed countries was responsible for the rapid decline of cervical cancer burden in those countries. But even then, the contribution of the socioeconomic factors cannot be understated. And again, the epidemiology, particularly the descriptive epidemiology, is heavily influenced by the intensity of screening and prevention efforts in different countries. So altogether, looking into the entire scenario globally, you have extremely optimistic, very encouraging scenarios in certain parts of the world, but pessimistic scenarios continue in other parts of the world, particularly in the high-risk regions of disease like sub-Saharan Africa. And in fact, even after all these years, one is extremely amazed and ashamed at the lack of advocacy for the control of cervical cancer in high-risk countries. On the one hand, you see a lot of advocates for cancer control, and particularly for breast cancer control. I'm not talking about in competing terms. I'm just looking at the enormous difference why there are no advocates. I think one of the important reasons why there is no advocates for cervical cancer screening is some type of stigma has been attached with this disease. This is undeniable. And in many societies, when we look into some of the reproductive experiences in very different lights, because it is heavily influenced by culture and attitudes, and in many societies, people are ashamed to talk about cervical cancer. The people who have been prevented, people who have been cured, the eminent people wouldn't come out and then say, because there is considerable stigma associated with disease. I mean, even though you don't call it as a sexually transmitted disease, I think people attach all the stigma associated with a sexually transmitted disease with cervical cancer. And this has been a major, major impediment for both for advocacy and for efforts to organize programs in high-risk regions. And again, this is very glaring again. From governmental resources and non-governmental resources, there has been very, very little investment over the last 2 or 3 decades in looking into ways of controlling disease. I think the major investment in the last decade has come from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for advancing cervical cancer prevention in high-risk regions. That's the only source which has, I would say, has enormously supported this cause, particularly in low-resource settings. This is quite often repeated geocancerology of cervical cancer. And in fact, our current estimates, IARC estimates, are around 500,000 new cancer cases every year in the world. And 80% of the burden is observed in southern countries, in Latin America, sub-Saharan Africa, and South and Southeast Asia. And in fact, how reliable are these estimates? I think these estimates are made from a set of data coming from population-based cancer registries, the mortality registers, and then in some instances from hospital-based frequency data. And for regions where such data are not available, the projections are made from the neighboring countries. So it is a sum total of the information provided by a number of different information systems. And quite often, the validity or the completeness or the accuracy of an information system depends upon what people in the health services contribute. For a population-based cancer registry to count in entire totality, the medical record systems in a given region should be excellent. In fact, the clinicians should be writing the diagnosis properly, the stage properly, how it is diagnosed. There are records available so that the cancer registries can accurately count the number of cancers occurring in a particular region. And in a mortality database, the counting depends upon the validity of the cause of death entered by doctors. And in fact, in many, many, many settings, people will just write, it is cardiorespiratory arrest as the cause of death. The cause of death is not available in many parts of the world. So when you look at these numbers, we should always think of the responsibility within the health services to provide accurate information in each and every medical record we complete, whether it is a patient-related medical record, or is it a death certificate, or any other information, a pathology report, or even an imagiology report. Everything contributes ultimately to the refinement of data collected from different sources. Fortunately, cancer is a very definite diagnosis. There is no doubt about cancer in many settings, whether it is clinically diagnosed, whether it is histologically diagnosed, or is diagnosed by any other means. But the major impediment has been documenting this information in a record. That has been a major problem. And if this problem is overcome for many cancers, the accuracy, the validity, and the accuracy of the estimates improve. So these are the projections for the year 2025. When you look into projections, you should always remember two things. The projections are affected by three factors. Factor number one, the absolute growth in population and the way the different populations will grow. And in such instances, you can never predict future. So one should avoid always projections like 2075 and 2100 because you never know what happens, what natural calamities will occur. So projections, people should always look into, say, like a 10, 15 year, a maximum, a 25 year future. The second thing is what will happen to the rates, the incidence rates of disease. The incidence rates of the disease will be heavily influenced by the etiological factors. What happens to the prevalence of different etiological factors, which are amenable to different types of interventions? Existing interventions may intensify, or new interventions may come, so it is very difficult to predict. So with these three uncertainties, the projections are made, and these are the projections taking into account, we have assumed in these projections, the incidence rates will remain more or less similar, and very little change in the incidence rates, and it essentially takes into population growth based on past experiences. So this indicates there is going to be almost a 100% increase in the incidence rates and almost a 75% increase in mortality for cervical cancer in a 25-year period. So it will be very interesting to see what happens. This is population-based survival data coming from some selected developing countries, low and medium resource countries, from where data are available. These are for the years 1990 to 2000. Some of the data are national data. All cervical cancers diagnosed in those countries, as gleaned from the population-based cancer registries, have been taken into account. For example, the national data are for South Korea, Singapore, Cuba, Costa Rica, and for other and Gambia. And for other countries, the data come from a few population-based cancer registries, essentially urban registries. What it shows here is, even among these low and medium resource countries, there is an almost a nine-fold difference in the outcome for cervical cancer, which reflects the difference in the way the health services are organized, the health services are efficient, or how easily they respond, or how effectively, efficiently they respond to the challenge of cervical cancer, and what prevention efforts and what early detection efforts are there in those countries. For example, in South Korea, the range in the different populations, for example, between Seoul and other populations, is very narrow. It's like 80 to 83% five-year survival. As opposed to you come to India, for example, in the data comes from five registries. There is a difference of about at most almost like 26 percentage points between the lowest survival rates and the highest survival rates. And then coming to sub-Saharan Africa, where essentially health services do not exist. I think this is not an overstatement when you say about sub-Saharan Africa. The diagnostic services are extremely limited. The possible exception is Republic of South Africa, you know, where things are much different from other African countries. And essentially, it is impossible for more than 90% of the people to access services in healthcare because this simply doesn't exist. And this is even true in the capital regions in some of these countries. So it is not at all surprising when you see some of the survival rates coming from Gambia and Uganda, like say less than 15%. It's not only advanced disease presentation, but it is also the difficulty in accessing services. Okay. It's very clear HPV infection is a necessary cause for cervical cancer. In the absence of HPV infection, cervical cancer cannot occur. There are several supplementary factors which may aid the process of carcinogenesis, but the presence of a persistent HPV infection is absolutely necessary for cervical carcinogenesis. And among the 13 to 15 high-risk types of HPV types which can cause cervical cancer, the risk is extremely high with HPV 16 and 18. This has been very clearly established in case control studies and follow-up studies. And again, if you look into the prevalence across the different types of cervical neoplasia for the different HPV types, this is again clear. And as Dr. Fraser said, it's clear that 99.99% of the cervical cancers will show the presence of HPV with the most sensitive techniques. And HPV 16 and 18, they account for approximately 70% of cervical cancers. And the proportion varies very little across the world, maybe like 65% for Africa, about 70% for Asia and Latin America, and about 75 to 80% for Europe and North America. So the difference, the attributable fraction contributed by HPV 16 and 18 in different parts of the world are practically very, very little. And this is again to show HPV 16 is probably responsible for around 45 to 55% of cervical cancers across the world, whereas HPV 18 is responsible anywhere between 10 to 20%. And again, looking into HPV prevalence, cancer incidence in five continents, which is published by IARC once in 5 years, is a very useful reference volume for cancer incidence in different continents. And if you look into, there is again something like a tenfold difference in cervical cancer incidence rates across the world. And if you look into the HPV prevalence, the high-risk HPV prevalence or the oncogenic HPV prevalence in different populations and look into the cancer incidence rates, there is some level of correlation. In populations like, say, North Vietnam, in Hanoi, where the cervical cancer incidence rate is around, say, like 4 per 100,000, the HPV prevalence in the population is like 2.5%. Whereas you go to some of the African populations, Why the cervical cancer incidence rates exceed 45 per 100,000, you will see a high-risk HPV infection prevalence more than 20%. You come to India, where the cervical cancer incidence rates range between 20 to 30 per 100,000, the high HPV prevalence is between 10 to 15%. And again, there are very interesting patterns, age-specific patterns, for HPV prevalence in both in developed and developing countries. And in fact, the highest risk of infection happens immediately after the sexual debut. So the populations less than 30 years of age, the HPV prevalence at any given point of time varies between, say, between 40 to 70%. Whereas as age advances, the proportion of the people with the prevalent infection is much lower, which again shows the considerable dynamics, the way the body clears the infection or goes into latent phase, the reinfection and things like that. But what is interesting is in many of the developing country populations, there seems to be a second peak which occurs in the fifth decade, which is debatable whether it is due to a recrudescence of latent infection or it is acquiring new infections. So, but it is very interesting to observe this. And based on the HPV prevalence surveys conducted by IARC in different populations across the world, one can generalize some of the patterns of HPV infection that you observe in populations in different continents. And what is interesting to see here is the extremely high prevalence of HPV infection in Africa, and the data coming from essentially from sub-Saharan Africa. It's very interesting to see, and these are the populations where you see cervical cancer incidence rates like 40 to 50 per 100,000. So this pattern is very interesting. And again, as we said earlier, there is enough information coming from different populations, both from developed countries and developing countries, to show that the highest risk of HPV infection is between in the second and third decades and after the onset of sexual debut. This data comes from Bogota in Colombia. Then what I would like to do in the next 10 minutes is to go continent by continent, essentially restricting myself to sub-Saharan Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And this is the incidence of cervical cancer, the estimated incidence rates coming from sub-Saharan Africa. It's less than 2% of the population in sub-Saharan Africa has been covered by reliable population-based cancer registries. So these exist in places like Harare, in Zimbabwe, the capital of Uganda, which is the Kyodondo County, and then in Mali, in the northern part of sub-Saharan Africa. And there are other population-based registries from where the data are not reliable, not complete, that has been not taken into account in many of the incidence publications. But for estimates, we take into account the data coming from whatever source which is available within Africa. And it shows again, within Africa, you have, if you look into the Maghrebian Africa, the Arab countries, the Maghrebian Arab countries in the North Africa, where the incidence rates are less than 5 per 100,000, but you come down, particularly to Eastern Africa, where the incidence rates are like 50, 55 per 100,000 populations. This is the estimated mortality rates, again showing very high mortality. In fact, in sub-Saharan Africa, we would imagine the mortality rates exceed 15 per 100,000 in many populations. And these are the real cancer incidence rates coming from population-based cancer registries, which have been included in the 9th volume of the Cancer Incidence in 5 Continents, published very recently, about 2 years ago. And this particular publication can be accessed in the IARC website. All the 9 volumes can be accessed. I would strongly encourage you, whenever you quote or you want to refer to population-based incidence patterns for different cancers, to look into these publications. So this shows almost, you see here, something like a 25-fold difference in Africa. In Egypt and Garbia region in Egypt, and Sousse city in Tunisia, and Sitif Velaya in Algeria, where the incidence rates are much lesser, less than 10 per 100,000. In fact, in Egypt, you see, it's like 3 per 100,000. Whereas you come to Harare, it is almost like 50 per 100,000. And these are the estimated rates, incidence and mortality rates based on the Globocan estimates for the year 2002 in Africa. In many parts of the world, cervical cancer rates are declining. Declining either due to long-standing cervical cancer screening programs or because of socioeconomic developments happening in many, many low and medium resource countries. And to a certain extent, the gynecologist doing a lot of hysterectomies in certain health services. That is also a certain implication, which has been never measured in a serious way. You know, what is the impact of this? It's very speculative. But if you look into Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, there is reason to believe either the cervical cancer rates are remaining stable or even increasing. There could be several caveats against this statement. For example, people would always say in Africa in earlier years, the measurement of incidence rates have been highly deficient. The information systems might have been inadequate or inefficient to begin with, or the health services were so inefficient that many of the cases which actually occurred were not diagnosed and documented in the health services so that the registries missed them. But whatever it is, looking at the data coming from some of the places like long-standing population-based cancer registries in Uganda and Harare in Zimbabwe, the rates are showing an increasing trend. So there is a reasonable evidence to believe in Africa, the incidence trends are different from the rest of the world. Then coming to Latin America, again a very high incidence region. And this region is very peculiar because many of the countries try to organize population-based cervical cancer screening programs as early as the 60s, 70s, either nationally or regionally, smaller countries going for national programs, larger countries going for regional programs, with the federal governments, the provincial governments, the city governments supporting the program, extensive inputs, but there has been considerable fragmentation in the efforts. The linkage between the coverage, screening, diagnosis, and treatment was non-existent in many of these countries. This was isolated efforts. Enormous resources were diverted into these programs, but the impact has been very minimal. The cost effectiveness of these programs in many of the Latin American countries, particularly in the 70s and 80s, is highly questionable. It took almost 2 to 3 decades for people to look into the data coming from mortality registers and the incidence registers to analyze why these programs have not been working, whether these programs have been working, and if not, why. So it took almost 2 decades for people to debate on this. And thanks to some of the pioneers in the region, from Mexico, in Cuba, in Costa Rica, and places like that, where people looked into the data coming from population-based registries and mortality registries, and were amazed, in spite of all these investments in countries like Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, Venezuela, you know, you name whatever country there has been in the Latin American region, there has been some effort in these countries to control cervical cancer. Very interesting situation, but very little impact due to these programs in the 70s and 80s and early 90s. And some of the countries started reorganizing programs. The Costa Rica reorganized by centralizing the laboratory services, introducing quality control into cervical cytology. And Chile, again, did the same thing, reorganization of the program, a much better invitation process, a much better effort at coverage, and then ensuring quality assurance, and then ensuring people who are diagnosed who are screen positive are investigated and treated with efficient treatment services. And Brazil is currently trying to reorganize the programs. But again, there has been very, very, very costly and unfounded concepts like screening colposcopy and things like that, which infiltrated the screening services in Latin America. In fact, The screening colposcopy and things like that are much, much, much cumbersome. This has been, again, essentially sort of indicates the considerable influence the medical community can have on programmatic aspects in countries without much evidence supporting such intervention. So there has been a mixture of several things going on in Latin America. So these are the projections. So a 25-year projection indicates something like an 80% increase in the burden of disease, provided the incidence rates are continuing like this, with almost more than 110% increase in the most interesting population group, which is 35 to 64 year age group. And there are considerable regional variations across countries, generally the rural areas having a higher rate than the urban areas. And these are the estimated age-adjusted incidence rates coming from the different sites. A highly predominant squamous cell cancer burden in those countries, more than 90%. And again, these are the age-specific incidence curves in two of the populations which have been subjected to considerable screening activity over the last 30 years, and where data are available, incidence data are available for more than the last 30 years. And which again shows in successive periods there has been a flattening of the curve, the age-specific incidence curve, for the populations which have been subjected for screening essentially predominantly between 25 and 65 age group, which shows some type of an impact of these programs, of the repeated screening programs in those populations. And in fact, in Puerto Rico, in this particular small population, there has been almost like a 90% decline in cervical cancer incidence rates in the last 30 years. And Mexico, a large country, considerable investment through the employee insurance services. Again, a fragmented effort. The different health services, the university-based health services, the health ministry-based health services, the employment, the insurance schemes, and everything. So different types of interventions, considerable smear-taking activity. And for many years, there has been very little impact. And then now Mexico is trying to reorganize the programs by introducing some of the new concepts in screening, like HPV testing. And Chile, no impact until 1995. Program was reorganized, quality assurance introduced, and considerable efforts in coverage for treatment. Then there is the decline has started emerging. A scenario exactly as in Great Britain. And similarly, Costa Rica, the centralization of laboratories, reorganization in 1998, and within 5 or 6 years, the impact starts to emerge. Then coming to the Asia-Pacific region, a very large region contributing almost like 60% of the global burden of disease, and particularly South Asia contributing an enormous burden of disease. And the projections for the next 25 years show almost like an 80% increase in burden over the next 25 years. And these are the incidence rates and mortality rates observed in different populations. You see almost like a 9-fold difference across the populations in the Asia-Pacific region, and most of the burden in South and Southeast Asia. In China, with its 1.4 billion population, has a very interesting pattern. The eastern regions of China in the Pacific coast, in large cities, very low rates, like less than 5 per 100,000. But what is interesting is there are certain interior regions of China which show very high mortality rates exceeding 15 per 100,000. And these particular populations showing very high mortality rates have been deficiently covered by cancer incidence. There is considerable scope to study what is the real incidence pattern in some of the interior populations of China, which will have an enormous impact on the global burden of disease estimates for cervical cancer. Then India, this is the Cancer Atlas of India, an effort which is based on both population-based registers and pathology-based registers, which shows considerable excess of cervical cancer risk in the rural populations of the country. So these are for some of the Pacific Islands. The Pacific Islands have the Polynesian and Melanesian Islands. They have, again, a high incidence rate. And these are in some selected Asian populations based on true population-based registry data spread across India, Singapore, Thailand, China, Japan, Korea, and other places, what it shows is it is extremely interesting data. And for China Shanghai, once you look into the rates have declined like 85% over the last 30 years. To begin with, in the 1930s and 1970s, the incidence rates around 35 per 100,000. And currently, the incidence rates are less than 5 per 100,000. And there has been no extensive screening in Shanghai population. And in fact, there has been some screening services in the industry. But the treatment linkage in the industrial screening services has been very limited. In fact, the reporting was based on certain type of Chinese characters. It didn't follow an international pattern. So it is not an intensive screening which has been responsible for this enormous decline in the risks in Shanghai. Very interesting. You know, what people are trying or people have achieved with so many years of organized screening. And in countries like Germany, screening every 6 months, every 1 year. And United States beginning at the age of 15 and 16, with considerable variation across the world, what people have achieved in about 30, 40 years of time has been achieved in China, in Shanghai, in some of the urban populations, in the eastern coast over the 30 years. Very interesting. One should really look into reasons why this has happened. So here you can see here, such a dramatic decline, the rates plateauing off in recent years. It will be very interesting to see with the China opening up what happens in future with the lack of screening services. And again, Singapore with its multi-ethnic populations showing the three different incidence patterns. The Singapore Indian community to begin with, very high rates as in southern India, where most of the Singapore Indian community originates from. And over the last 30 years, this community has particularly achieved something like a 70% decline in risk of disease. And again, the mortality rates showing a decline in many of the populations. So finally, there are two interventions emerging. I mean, an intervention emerging and intervention existing. Vaccination is an emerging intervention. Very effective intervention, potentially very effective. But its implementation is going to be extremely challenging, particularly in high-risk regions. There are so many vaccines emerging for so many diseases. Rotaviral vaccine, Haemophilus influenza vaccine, pneumococcal vaccine, meningococcal vaccine, and so many interested parties competing for introducing a new vaccine through the extended program of immunization. The single most important platform for introducing vaccination in any country is the National Immunization Program, which is the extended program of immunization. Unless a vaccine finds a place in the epi vaccine, one can really say the possibility of this vaccine to reach a critical coverage will not exist. And getting a place in epi is a considerable competition between different stakeholders, pediatric communities, gynecology community, preventive medicine, politicians, industry, the burden of disease, many, many things. And in many places, people may argue the rotaviral diarrheal illness is killing almost like a million children in developing countries. The pneumococcal pneumonia is responsible for almost like 2 million deaths of children. And then you have cervical cancer, which kills, by the most conservative estimates, like 500,000 people in a year. And with considerable difference in costs. So it's a very, very challenging and interesting scenario. And the possibility of introducing new vaccines into epi is a very challenging task. At the moment, the epi vaccines minus the hepatitis B vaccine in most developing countries, the public health services purchase for less than $1. And when they give it through the public health service, the essential cost of delivering an epi vaccine to a child in most sub-Saharan African countries and most Asian countries is less than $2 per person. And this is around less than $6 in the Latin American region. And then when you add hepatitis B vaccine, the countries add another $3 more into the epi expenditure. So you have to see at what critical cost levels ultimately the human papillomaviral vaccine has to come down. And this can happen, I mean, this may happen eventually over the years, because so many competitors coming in, the Western companies reducing prices, a differential pricing pattern. But again, this will be heavily influenced by biotechnology developments in China, in Brazil, in India, and other countries. And again, the existing intervention screening, there are a number of interventions available at the moment. I think I would agree with Ian when he said that visual screening and things like that is a temporary phenomenon. Eventually, the screening has to be driven by a much more sensitive and highly reproducible objective technique, and that seems to be HPV testing at the moment. And with the development of new vaccine platforms, new testing formats like the CARE HPV test coming into development at the moment. This is a new HPV test where the results will be available in less than 3 hours and with a much cheaper equipment and technology. So such technological innovations will drive the what type of testing that you will rely for screening eventually in the future. But essentially, the critical development is we have been concentrating so much on screening tests, but essentially, the success of screening will depend upon how efficient the health services are going to be in different settings. Thank you for your attention.